2005 was a big year if you were or are a Mormon. Now, the rest of it, just let this pass by without even paying attention. 200 years since the birth of Joseph Smith. For some people, Joseph Smith is, well, the most significant person in their lives. If you're a Latter-day Saint, Joseph Smith is it. So we're going to talk a little bit about the bicentennial celebrations honoring the birth of Joseph Smith here in the first half hour of Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. You can join us as well. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. We have an in-studio email address coming to you live this Monday. What is it, the 6th of March already? IssuesETC@KFUO.org. IssuesETC@KFUO.org. After the first half hour, we're going to spend some time, just a few minutes, with David Erickson. He is the illustrator for our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for March, He Has Risen Indeed. It's a picture book for kids. We're going to talk about creating art for Christian books. At 3:45 through the next hour after that, open lines for your questions and your comments. Last night, if you watched the Oscars, you were in the minority, I imagine, last night. It did not do too well in the ratings. Second lowest ratings ever for the Oscars program. And there was a surprise. Brokeback Mountain? No. Crash. Did you watch the Oscars? And if you did, what did you think? And then, more generally, what was your best movie, in your opinion, in the last year? We're also going to hear some audio during that open lines on the South Dakota law. Yes, it is now a law banning abortion in South Dakota. The governor, just a few hours ago, signed it into law. All abortions, with the exception of those necessary to save the life of the mother, are banned in South Dakota. That won't last long, of course. There will be court challenge. We're going to be hearing some of that audio and getting your thoughts and your reaction to it as well. At 4:45, Dr. Doug Guyvett joins us from the Talbot School of Theology. We're going to review the book, The End of Faith. Sam Harris is making the rounds on this book. He says that religion, just religion in general, Christianity, Judaism, whatever it may be, Islam, is to blame for most of the ills in society. It's time for faith to come to an end and to approach life rationally. Then Uwe Simonetto joins us for the last half hour of the program. We'll continue our series on vocation, on lay vocation. We'll talk about the vocation of spouse in the last half hour. Again, our call-in number is 505-7850. Or 1-800-730-2727. Bill McKeever is our first guest. He's founder of Mormonism Research Ministry based in Draper, Utah. And he's authored an article in the latest Christian Research Journal titled Year of Celebrations Honors Mormon Founder. Bill, welcome back.
It's good to be with you. How are you doing, Todd?
I'm doing well. What were the Latter-day Saints celebrating all through 2005?
Well, 2005 was the 200th anniversary of the birthday of Joseph Smith, who, of course, founded the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, otherwise known as the Mormon Church. And throughout the year, the Mormon Church put on numerous presentations, pageants, speaking engagements, things like this, all honoring Joseph Smith and extolling him throughout that year.
Who do Mormons believe Joseph Smith was, and who do they believe he is now?
Well, they claim that Joseph Smith was just a simple man who was called by God to restore true Christianity back to the earth. One of the primary foundational teachings of Mormonism is that Christianity was lost during what is known as the Great Apostasy. When exactly that happened, no Mormon leader has ever really come forth and given an exact date, but they believe that it began during the life of the apostles and culminated in the Council of Nicaea in 325 AD. Since that time, they believe there was really no true Christianity on the earth, that all priesthood authority had been lost, and though there may have been some truth floating around out there, they didn't have all the truth necessary to get the best God has for his people. And so in the early 1800s, when Joseph Smith was but a young boy of around 14, he claims that he was visited by God the Father and Jesus Christ, and that these personages told him that all the churches were wrong, that their creeds were an abomination, and their professors were all corrupt. And Smith felt from that time forth that he was called to be a modern-day prophet to bring back all those things that he said were lost.
Okay, let's get into those founding experiences that Smith claimed to have had in just a minute. But first of all, Walk us through the briefest history possible. I know it's rather convoluted and complex, of Mormonism from Joseph Smith until today.
Well, Mormonism from Joseph Smith until today, you're right, that is convoluted, because I don't think there really are a whole lot of Mormons practicing today like Joseph Smith or Brigham Young would have practiced back then. In fact, I've often said that if Joseph Smith and Brigham Young came back from the dead today and tried to get back in the Mormon church, even if they succeeded, they would probably be kicked out for having behavior that isn't acceptable today. And that's what makes Mormonism really kind of fascinating, is that they have this concept known as Latter-day Revelation, and the new leader can really abrogate teachings of the past. And so there is no real set standard for truth. It really boils down to what is the current leader in Salt Lake City saying right now. Now, you do have a lot of Mormons that will say, well, everything has to be grounded in the standard works. But unfortunately, when you look at the standard works, it actually opens the door for this Latter-day Revelation. And it sometimes is very difficult to meld the two teachings. For instance, Brigham Young's Adam God teaching, for instance, would be probably easier to support using the Doctrine and Covenants, but it would be difficult to use it, use the Bible or the Book of Mormon to support it. But Brigham Young was the prophet at that time. He taught it as a doctrine. He claimed that if you make light of it or treat it with indifference, it'll prove your salvation or damnation. And so a lot of emphasis is put on the prophet of the Mormon church. Now, Smith is given a high priority mainly because he founded this movement. And so, unfortunately, I think a lot of Joseph Smith's dubious behavior is ignored. And, in fact, I just went just last week down to Temple Square and watched the new film on Joseph Smith called Prophet of the Restoration. And I wasn't totally surprised. It was very typical of most films on Joseph Smith, to where they have to really ignore a lot of what Joseph Smith did as far as his social behavior, and even a lot of the things that he taught. A lot of these things are just glossed over. There's no mention of his polygamy. There's no mention of the fact that he had at least 10 wives that were simultaneously married to other men at the time Joseph Smith was alive. They don't mention any of these things. And unfortunately, tourists going and watching this film are going to get a very polished view of Joseph Smith, and one that I made the comment afterwards. I said, boy, watching that film, it doesn't sound like that's the Joseph Smith of Richard L. Bushman, who's a Mormon historian, who wrote a book called Joseph Smith, Rough Stone Rolling, which also came out last year. But Bushman portrays, to me, a much different picture of Joseph Smith. And he admits at least to a lot of his foibles, and he admits at least to a lot of the things that he taught that caused a lot of consternation among leaders in the early days, and caused some people to doubt and things like that. So it really is an interesting study when you look at Mormonism. Unfortunately, most people being approached by the missionaries today are not going to get a full picture. I mean, let's be serious. All they're going to get is what this 19- or 20-year-old missionary knows, and how much could that possibly be? Though many missionaries are very zealous, I find that very many of them have only a limited understanding of Mormon history and doctrine.
Now, when did Mormonism go from being kind of a group of oddball immigrants moving around, kind of constantly on the run, being led by inspirational and charismatic personalities, like the two great ones, Joseph Smith and Brigham Young, to the more or less kind of machine that it is now, with a very bureaucratic, very hierarchical?
Yeah, I think that's an excellent question. I would probably say that Gordon Hinckley, who is the current president, is right now, has probably been more responsible for kind of like bringing Mormonism into the, I hate to use the word mainstream, because of course to us that means one thing, but I think giving it some legitimacy. Hinckley has been excellent in doing that. He is a communications wizard, if you want to use that word, or genius, and he has been able to bring Mormonism into the forefront in a way that he surprisingly has made it look very favorable. Again, Hinckley does not touch on a lot of the controversial issues. He sidesteps them all the time. If you've ever listened to Gordon Hinckley being interviewed, by either Mike Wallace or Larry King or people like that, he's never really given the hard questions. He's always given these softball puff, you know, questions. And he's very good at sidestepping a lot of the things, like the polygamy issue. He'll merely say, well, we don't practice it. It's illegal. It's not a part of us. That's, you know, splinter groups. But what he doesn't tell you is that polygamy is still very much a part of the Mormon church. Mormon leaders have said in the past that it is going to be practiced in the hereafter, and that the reason it's not being practiced now is because it's illegal. Well, what are they going to do when it does become legal, if it does? And that is really not such a far-fetched possibility when you have this same-sex marriage issue going around right now. I mean, they are really trying, at least here in the state of Utah, to overturn the anti-polygamy laws. So that could quite be a possibility. I don't know. But what is the Mormon Church going to do then?
Well, and that's kind of always the question, it seems, with Mormonism, because it seems a religion shaped as much by the men at its inception and their personal circumstances. Mm-hmm. On the wrong side of the law, running from one. You know, they make this great pilgrimage out to Utah, which when it's all said and done, they said this was God's will, but really the leaders are just trying to get away from the police.
Well, Brigham Young had his problems. Joseph Smith, of course, had his problems. There's no doubt about that. But what is really interesting is there was always this prediction that they would end up going back. They would end up go back and build the temple in Independence, Missouri, and so forth and so on, and you don't hear anything like that. What's really interesting about this is in his book, Sidney Rigdon, A Portrait of Religious Success, Richard Van Wagner, a Mormon historian, points out that one of the reasons why Mormonism grew so rapidly is because there was always this constant preaching of Christ's imminent return, that it could happen at any moment and you better be in the right boat. And, of course, this was around the same time as the Millerites and people like that, who were, of course, predicting the immediate return of Christ also. It's funny, you don't hear any talk about that anymore in Mormon circles. I can't recall ever in recent history hearing any statements in General Conference or even in a lot of their writings in the Ensign magazine talking about the imminent return of Christ. It's not even an issue with most Mormons anymore. And I don't know whether they think he's not coming back right away, or they don't think it's really all that necessary to teach that subject anymore. I don't know. But it is interesting how it has kind of evolved over the years. And another thing that shapes Mormonism is public opinion, surprisingly. Public pressure will also shape Mormon doctrine. We saw that happen in 1978 when the Mormon Church reversed its position on the ban regarding blacks holding the priesthood. That was coming down very heavy on them, both in the court of public opinion and in the legal realm, with the IRS wanting, you know, threatening to take away tax exempt status and things like that. So there's a lot of things that shape it. Of course, the Mormons would insist that they are led by Latter-day Revelation and God speaking through their prophets. And, you know, I guess we have to expect that kind of an answer coming from them.
When the average Mormon looks back on someone like Joseph Smith, beyond what they're taught to say, and I'm thinking here about the young men who are sent out to do their mission, beyond what they're taught to say at the door, does the average Mormon know much more about the man Joseph Smith?
Not unless they are reading outside the realm of faith-promoting history. And what I mean by that is there are books that are written on Joseph Smith, such as the one I mentioned earlier, Richard Bushman's book. But Bushman's book is not published by the church. It was actually published by a secular publisher. And if a person wanted to venture outside the realm of church-sanctioned publications, they can find this information. But I find many of them don't. They don't feel it necessary to really do an all in-depth study of either Joseph Smith or even their theology, for that instance, for that example. You have in Mormonism a very subjective way of determining truth. A lot of it is based on personal feelings, and if they feel it is true, many of them don't feel it is also important for them to start digging into a lot of this stuff. They know Joseph Smith was a prophet of God, and for many of them, that's all that matters. And anything that you might say that shows Joseph Smith in a negative light must be nothing more than lies from the enemy. And so many Mormons won't even entertain the thought. I recall just last year I was speaking to two Mormon women out on the streets of Manti, Utah, And we were having a great conversation discussing a number of issues. But when the conversation started going towards Joseph Smith and I started bringing up some things about Joseph Smith, one of the ladies instantly cut me off and said, "Don't say anything negative about Joseph Smith or we'll end this conversation right now." Hmm. And that's the way she was. I mean, you weren't going to go any further with her. So.
But am I right in my perception that, in a very real sense, Bill, the credibility of Mormonism and its truth claims really does hinge upon the credibility of that man, Joseph Smith?
Oh, yeah, you're absolutely correct. In fact, Joseph Fielding Smith, the 10th president of the church, said the story of Mormonism stands on the testimony of Joseph Smith. He was either a prophet of God, divinely called and commissioned, or he was one of the biggest frauds the world has ever seen. There is no middle ground, he said. And I would agree with that statement. Unfortunately, as I mentioned, a lot of people don't take the time to really examine what kind of a man this guy was. And if they did, I really doubt that they would be all that enamored with him if a man like that lived here today. He had a credibility problem, among people that lived around him. With his behavior sexually with other women, and then lying to his wife Emma about these wives that he had, even lying to his own lieutenants that were close to him in the church hierarchy. A man who will lie to his wife will lie to anybody, and unfortunately, Mormons don't see this aspect of Joseph Smith. They tend to turn a blind eye to him and speak of only this concept that he restored true Christianity and how great that is, because through his restoration of Christianity now, they can become gods or they can be with their family throughout eternity. And of course, a lot of these things that Mormons are really hoping for, you can't find any support for it in the Bible. It all comes through Joseph Smith. Everything hinges on him.
Bill McKeever is our guest. We're talking about the bicentennial celebrations recently concluded for the year 2005, honoring the birth of Joseph Smith. Bill McKeever is founder of Mormonism Research Ministry based in Draper, Utah. He's authored an article in the latest Christian Research Journal titled Year of Celebration Honors Mormon Founder. By the way, the website for Mormonism Research Ministry, mrm.org, www.mrm.org. Bill, the facts, the history of Joseph Smith is readily available. There are all sorts of books out there. People can pick them up and read them any place they want to. So what is the appeal? Why is it that Joseph Smith is still the main and the first appeal made when someone is approached by a Mormon? The first thing they want to talk about usually is Joseph Smith.
Well, I would have to say that a person that would be promoting Mormonism by going through the person of Joseph Smith probably does not have either a full understanding of who this man was, or they're purposely going to hide a lot of the information regarding him. I know when people talk to me about Joseph Smith and I bring up some of these things, they seem to be troubled by the same things that I'm troubled by. And what's interesting is Richard L. Bushman seems to be troubled by it also, because when you read his book, he doesn't understand the polygamy aspect or the polyandry aspect. He sounds very troubled by it as well. I really don't know. They bring these things up mainly because theologically, Joseph Smith restores true Christianity. That is a big selling point here. You need Joseph Smith. You need the restoration. Christianity, as it has been known for the past 2,000 years, is not enough. Too many things have been lost. There's too much confusion, they would say. So we need Joseph Smith to kind of point us in the right direction. Again, the problem is, well, is the right direction really the true direction? Because, as I said, many of the things Joseph Smith introduces are very difficult to support through the Bible. The early Christians would not have known what he was talking about, yet they insist that this is the way the early church believed and practiced.
Is Joseph Smith for Mormonism, especially for Mormon officialdom, kind of the official line, is he more than a man to them? Now, you mentioned in your article there's actually a hymn. It dates from the 19th century, but it's a hymn, Praise to the Man. Praise to the man who communed with Jehovah. Jesus anointed that prophet and seer, blessed to open the last dispensation. Kings shall extol him and nations revere. Is Joseph Smith more than a man?
Well, you would think so, reading those kind of hymns and reading about him that he certainly is more than a man. Now, the Mormons will insist that they don't worship Joseph Smith. In fact, that was one of the big things they made very strongly a point in the early part of last year, was though they do revere him as a prophet of God, they do not worship him. And that theme was kind of echoed throughout last year. But when you do see songs like this, because one of the stanzas, mingling with gods, he can plan for his brethren, death cannot conquer the hero again. I mean, to us, those are very troubling verses. And when you consider the song that Gordon Hinckley made reference to in conference a while back, the song The Seer, Joseph the Seer, very troubling words. Unchanged in death with a Savior's love, he pleads their cause in the courts above. I mean, that's an attribute that we as Christians give to our Lord. And here they are giving it to Joseph Smith. These are very troubling verses. But yet, if you ask Mormons, do you worship Joseph Smith? They would insist, no, absolutely not. They don't. But certainly they do revere him in what is my opinion, a very uncomfortable manner. We don't even speak of Peter and Paul in words like that.
When the Mormons are celebrating the 300th anniversary of Joseph Smith's birth, 100 years from now, 99 years from now, what do you think will have changed for Mormonism?
Wow, that is a question I haven't even really thought about. You've only got a minute to answer that, Todd.
Only a minute to respond. Well, where do you see it heading in less than 100 years?
Well, right now, the way I see it heading is I see them de-emphasizing a lot of the things, at least publicly, that have always separated them from the rest of Christianity. And I see that being de-emphasized more and more publicly, but I still find in their church manuals and such, they are teaching the same old things that they've always taught. I don't see this rapid rush to orthodoxy coming from the Mormon leadership at this point. I would like to see that. There are some people who seem to think that as some of these students from BYU, being under more liberal professors at BYU, maybe that could happen in about 50 years. I would like to see that. There would be nothing I'd like better than to see the Mormon church come to a Christian orthodoxy. Unfortunately, I just don't see it happening in the immediate future. But what are they going to do with Joseph Smith? They can't get rid of him. He's a foundation to the faith. You can't get rid of him. All you can really do is just keep spinning who he was and keep ignoring what he was really like. So I don't see that happening. At least I don't see it. Maybe others might see that happening, but I don't at this point.
Bill McKeever is founder of Mormonism Research Ministry based in Draper, Utah. Their website address, www.mrm.org. That's mrm.org. Bill's also author of an article in the latest Christian Research Journal titled Year of Celebration Honors Mormon Founder. He joined us to talk about those bicentennial celebrations of Joseph Smith's birth among the Latter-day Saints. Bill, it's always a pleasure, and thanks for being our guest.
Thank you, Todd. You have a great day.
You too. When we come back from this break, we're going to spend just a few minutes talking with David Erickson. He is the illustrator of a picture book that is our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for March. He is risen indeed. You know, it's really no small task to pick up your canvas and your paintbrush and paint these events, the suffering, the death, and the resurrection of Jesus Christ. We'll talk about creating art for Christian books right after this.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
St. Paul says, if Christ has not been raised from the dead, then our faith is in vain, and we of all men are most to be pitied. There is no more important truth than the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ for us sinners. And it's never too early to begin teaching your children and grandchildren that truth. He is risen indeed is the name of our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for March. It's a children's book that tells the story of Jesus' death and resurrection. Find out more about this book at our website, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Publishing House and order He is Risen Indeed for your child or your grandchild, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. He is Risen Indeed is $12.99 plus shipping and handling, 1-800-325-3040, or issuesetc.org.
It's urgent that local Christians get involved in ministry. This Global Minute lets you hear the news that comes from a missionary family in Venezuela. Several months ago, the president of Venezuela announced his decision for the mission agency New Tribes Mission to leave the country. The plan was to keep missionaries out of all indigenous areas. A missionary family with Mission Aviation Fellowship recently wrote the decision is affecting all mission agencies who want to disciple Christians in Venezuelan tribes. On a positive note, the news has made both Indian and Spanish evangelical churches realize why they need to get active in cross-cultural ministry. Some high-ranking officials in military and civilian posts have expressed their friendship and appreciation for the work of MAF and other missionaries. Now pray the Venezuelan church will stay strong and multiply in the face of opposition. Pray for breakthroughs around the world on the website missionvisionnetwork.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. Yesterday was the 60th anniversary of one of the most significant speeches of the 20th century. On March 5, 1946, Winston Churchill gave his famous Iron Curtain speech. He said, "From Stettin in the Baltic to Trieste in the Adriatic, an Iron Curtain has descended across the continent. Warsaw, Berlin, Prague, Vienna, Budapest, Belgrade, Bucharest, and Sofia, all these famous cities and the populations around them lie in what I must call the Soviet sphere, and all are subject to a very high, and in some cases increasing, measure of control from Moscow." Churchill gave the speech at Little Westminster College in Fulton, Missouri. "Today's students don't seem overly impressed," said student Chris Campbell. "We have been doing this for 60 years, and it's time to give it up." Administrator Pat Kirby acknowledged, writes Kavita Kumar, the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, that Churchill's connection may be more alluring to international students for whom the Cold War holds more meaning than for American students. Churchill said that day, "Our difficulties and dangers will not be removed by closing our eyes to them. They will not be removed by mere waiting to see what happens, nor will they be removed by a policy of appeasement." Are we teaching our children and grandchildren the relevancy of the past for the longed-for peace of the future?
The Missouri History Museum, Lindeland de Bolivar in Forest Park, features special exhibitions, and the Library and Research Center specializes in history, but the Missouri Historical Society also offers special interest tours that are theme-based. One such tour explores women of influence in the St. Louis area and would fit nicely with your viewing of the First Lady's Political Role and Public Image Special Exhibition at the History Museum. That's just one example. Visit mohistory.org for more.
All right, coming up in 10 minutes, we've got open lines for your questions and your comments. We're going to have a little piece on the Oscars, and I want to know from you, were you surprised that Brokeback Mountain, which was the one that was so nominated, this movie about the two gay cowboys, didn't really walk away with much, and it was Crash that actually got Best Picture. Were you surprised? Did you watch the Oscars? And what do you think was the best film of last year? We're going to be opening the phone lines in about 10 minutes for your questions and your comments. We'll be giving away to the best callers during that hour of open lines Brian Godawa's book, Hollywood Worldviews. And I want to hear from you. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Oh, we'll also get an update on the court case involving the Da Vinci Code. And did you hear about this Domino's, the former founder of Domino's Pizza? He founded it. Then he sold it for $1 billion. And now he wants to start a Catholic... Well, people are saying he wants to start a Catholic town. We're going to hear a piece on that during open lines as well. David Erickson is our guest for the next 10 minutes. We're going to talk about creating art for Christian books. He's the illustrator of our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for March, a picture book for kids called He Is Risen Indeed. David, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hello, Todd.
David, it's nice to hear that you're a fan of the program.
Yeah, I really am. I do. I listen to you every day. On the archive page, so I don't listen to you live. I'm up here in Minnesota. But I'm a huge fan of the show, and I like what you bring to my little studio every day. You're a great host, and I like your ideas.
What's your favorite topics and guests, just, you know, off the top of your head, David?
Well, I just have an interest in the history of the New Testament and, you know, Dr. Paul Meyer is always an interest for me. John Wark Montgomery, I love it when he's on the show. Apologetic-oriented things, I find that an interest in that type of subject matter.
You know, in a picture book like this one we're going to be talking about, He Is Risen Indeed, yeah. you can almost not have a text. You could almost just have entirely in pictures, or maybe just a little bitty, tiny bit. And there is just very little text here, and it's drawn directly from the scriptures on each page. How do you go about surmounting what has got to be a mountain of a subject for art, and that is these events surrounding Christ's death and burial and resurrection?
Yeah. Well, what I first did was actually write my own narrative of the story. I actually wrote copy and sent it to CBH, the publishers, beginning with the events of Good Friday and ending with Sunday evening when Jesus meets in the upper room with his disciples. And I actually wrote down a chronology of events as how I comprehended it through the four Gospels. And then from that, you can kind of pick and choose what you want to illustrate.
Now, I notice a lot of your illustrations focus on the women surrounding this event. Of course, that's where the narrative leads us to. Talk about that, if you would, David.
Yeah, that was really what drew my interest in the very beginning. I was talking to some guy on the Internet, and he was an unbeliever, and he introduced to me these contradictions of how you can't, you know, who's meeting who, and what angel, how many angels, and so forth. And I, just as a way of being a clear-minded apologist, if you will, I wanted to come back with him an account of how I thought the whole thing played out. And then that naturally had me investigating these women.
You know, most children's books don't begin with a death, but this one does. I mean, it starts with the most significant and life-giving death there is, and that is of Jesus Christ. When you're painting that first picture, and you're right there at the sixth hour where Christ gives up the ghost, how do you go about doing this when you know that it's going to be kids, and in many cases, very small kids, who are going to be looking at this first page of the book?
Right. Well, I went literal. I just basically thought, well, where are they? Well, I think, from what I understand, they must have been in or near a quarry, and that provided for me kind of a good metaphor for the rest of the book. The illustrations in the first half of the book or so are cold and cool colored and not a lot of vegetation. And as we move toward Mary Magdalene meeting with Jesus a little bit later on in the book, everything changes. The colors are warmed. We have vegetation all around. It's just it provided for me, even though it was all literally conceived in my mind, it provided for me a very good metaphor or narrative tool to move throughout the story. You know, things are cold and dark and gloomy at first, and then when Jesus appears to Mary Magdalene, everything changes.
Was there a painting that that came to you first? I know that when I write, I don't write from beginning to end. I write what comes first. So it might be the middle, it might be the end, it might be the beginning.
Yep.
But whatever occurs first and I can get on paper first, just to get started with ink on paper, I do that one first. Which one was that for you in these pictures?
Well, that one probably would have been where the three women meet the angels inside of the tomb. And I thought that was, I still think that would have been an amazing scene to behold, because the tomb was most likely a small cave, and it was very dark, and the sun was just coming up or very early in the morning. And all of a sudden, there are these three women meet two angels, and the angels, you know, say, you know, why are you looking for the dead or living among the dead? And meeting an angel in a dark cave had to have been one of the most profound experiences in their life. I mean, that, and to me, that was sort of one of the two major climaxes in the narrative of this story. The second major climax is, of course, when Jesus meets up with Mary Magdalene.
Do you use models or pictures of models to do the pictures?
Absolutely. I take many hundreds of reference photos. I go to my models. Most of my models are people from church. Some of them, Mary Magdalene was, she works in a grocery store in my town, And a lot of them are just people that I know. And Jesus is my brother-in-law.
No kidding.
No, yeah. He's my wife's twin brother. My wife's name is Monica, and his name is Marvin. He doesn't have a beard, and it's kind of funny because Marvin is now 40, which, whoops, I just gave away my wife's age, didn't I? And I told Marv, you know, I think the window's about closing in on you for being my Jesus model, because I paint Jesus quite a bit. And I don't want Jesus looking too old, you know, in future art. But, yeah, I use models all the time, and I dress them out in costumes and things
like
that.
Do you actually set up a scene or light it? I'm looking at this one of Jesus appearing to, this is the John 20 passage where Jesus appears and breathes on them and says, receive the Holy Spirit. And they're all sitting at a table around eating, and the wind is blowing the curtains on the windows in the upper room and everything. Do you set up the whole scene like that?
Yeah, it's a lot of it is conceived on Photoshop. We illustrators nowadays do a lot of work on Photoshop before we actually get to the drawing part of it. And you can find lots of reference photos online or in books and so forth. And it's basically putting a jigsaw puzzle together on the Photoshop. And it looks awfully messy on Photoshop, but once you get to drawing it out and painting it, it really comes to life.
Do you have a favorite among these?
Well,
you had mentioned the one of the women in the tomb.
Yeah, I do like that one a lot. I also like the one where Mary is telling Peter and John the news of having just met up with Jesus, or no, the news of that she saw that the tomb, the stone was rolled and the tomb was empty, and Peter has such a fantastic quizzical look on his face, and John has a look of a very skeptical look in his eye, and it's a real page turner. I think you want to find out what's going on after that. It was very model intense. I had to take a lot of pictures of these guys, saying, "Okay, now you're confused, now you're skeptical. Let's try it again. There was a lot of photography work, but they were very, very cooperative, and the whole thing worked out really well.
Now, I'll tell you which one is my favorite, David. And it is the one where John and Peter are down in the tomb, and they're right by the slab. There's the bloody garments laying there on the slab. No Jesus. And there's a lot of movement in this picture, even though there's not a lot of detail because the background is so dark. But you've got, I believe, John, or I think maybe Peter, he's reaching toward this place where Jesus is laid, but he's not. He looks like, I'm not about to touch this.
Right. Yeah. It's in my mind. It's where the disciples are drawn back to the supernatural, and Peter doesn't know what to think about this. Should he even touch it or not? And it's such an. And then he sees that the headcloth is folded, and then he sees there's blood on the linen, and it just blows him away. And it's the moment in the cave where Peter and John understand, you know, their worldview is it brought back into reality again, and that the supernatural is at work here, and it just blows them away.
Then one thing that struck me when I was looking through this a couple of days ago, David, is that when you depict the risen Christ, you do it in a very realistic way. It looks like an ordinary man with holes in his hands.
Yeah.
There's no halo. There's no special glow about him. This, especially as you're, you know, putting together the pictures, this is Jesus alive again.
Yeah, and I did do a little bit. I stuck a little bit with traditional approach. He's sort of in the light garment. He's not. But on the other hand, it looks like he's in the sort of clothing that a guy in that time period would also work in. His sleeves are a little bit pulled up, and that's kind of how I like to think about Jesus as you know, he's always working for me. He's always at work for me, and a good way for me to convey that visually is to have his sleeves be kind of rolled up or kind of pulled up to indicate that he's a working guy.
You know, you're aware, I'm certain, since you've illustrated a number of books,
that
some of the pictures you're going to paint are going to be for the kids who see them. They're going to be those pictures that stick with them for their entire life. I mean, that's the way it is for picture books I had when I was a kid, especially on this subject. What do you take into consideration, knowing that these are going to be the pictures that many children will carry with them into adulthood?
Well, it was important for me to stay literal. I didn't want to be too inventive, and I wanted to be pretty. I wanted to be straightforward and just paint straightforward clothing on these people, and that would be enough combined with the actual narrative to provide for an impact on the children who are listening as their moms and dads are reading this to them. It's just all literal, concrete illustration. There's very little fudging around with the illustrations. I try and be as straightforward as I can, and still have it be, you know, each painting, I try to make it visually interesting and pretty and so forth. But I want to be literal. I want to be true to life.
Two final questions, real quick on the first one. How long did it take you to do all these?
One painting actually took me one night because I was in a huge hurry, and I'm not going to tell you which one. being a freelance illustrator, I'm always doing more than one project at once, so it's hard to say how long a given painting would. But the painting of the women meeting the angels in the tomb, that painting might take me about a week, including photography, and then photoshopping and drawing it out and painting and so forth.
And finally, why would this book, He Is Risen Indeed, why would this make a great Easter gift for a young child or a grandchild or a godchild?
Well, first of all, and this is important, it has the scripture on each page. And so mom and dad are reading scripture on each and every page of this book. And that, from when the publisher suggested that we do it that way, that was a great idea to do it that way, because the kids are hearing in mom or dad's lap scripture, and not some author's reinterpretation of it or anything like that. And that's real blessing that I'm able to combine my artwork with actual scriptures. It's kind of intimidating, but that's an important thing for me. And now the parents have that to share that with their kids too.
Our Issues Etc. book of the month is called He Is Risen Indeed. It's a picture book for your kid, your grandkid, your godchild. It is illustrated by our guest in this last few minutes, David Erickson. The book is $12.99 plus shipping and handling. And for more information on it, you can go and at least see the cover art, which is the kind of the money shot of Jesus and Mary Magdalene there in the garden, at our website, issuesetc.org. Browse before you buy right there, issuesetc.org. Or you can call Concordia Publishing House and order any weekday during regular business hours. As I mentioned, this would make a great Easter gift for your child, your grandchild, or your godchild. 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. Or there are two locations. You can just go in and pick up the book, one at 3558 South Jefferson in the city, or here on the campus of Concordia Seminary in Clayton. Just follow the signs to the CPH bookstore and look for the Issues Etc. book of the month for March, He Is Risen Indeed. David Erickson, thank you very much for being our guest, and thanks for all the work you put into this book.
Well, thank you, Todd, and thank you for your program. It's really a blessing for me every day.
David Erickson is the illustrator of our Issues Etc. book of the month for March, He Is Risen Indeed. Well, for the remainder of this hour and on into the next, an hour of open lines is ahead. I didn't watch the Oscars because I was busy last night. I work on Sunday nights. I don't know if I would have. Not many of the movies appealed to me, except the one that won Best Picture, and that was Crash. It really appealed to me. Didn't make a lot of money. It really didn't. In fact, none of the movies nominated made a ton of money. Brokeback Mountain, the one that everyone thought would win, the one that many people wondered, will it win, didn't really do much. Well, which was your favorite movie this last year? So many people I've heard in the news today say, well, look, I'm just giving up on movies. They're just not that good, and 2005 was not that great of a year. Which, for you, was the best film of 2005? Did you watch the Oscars last night? And if so, what did you think? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. It's Open Lines, Issues, etc. Now, if you're like me, you don't see a lot on the big screen anymore. In fact, that's a big problem nowadays. People are headed for the rental counter before they go to the popcorn counter there in the cinema, Cinemaplex. So Did you rent it on DVD? And if so, what was your favorite film? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. The best callers, emailers, will get a copy of Brian Godawa's book called Hollywood Worldviews, Watching Film with Wisdom and Discernment. 1-800-730-2727, 505-7850, or our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Here's a piece from CNN. They've titled the package, Brokeback Falls with a Crash. You get the play on the words there. It's an upset for Best Picture and the rest of the Academy Awards. This is CNN's Sibylla Vargas reporting.
And the Oscar goes to Crash.
The big win and the big surprise of the night for Best Picture, Crash.
We are humbled by the other nominees in this category. You have made this year one of the most breathtaking and stunning maverick years in American cinema.
The maverick small-budget film about race and class upset the much-buzzed frontrunner Brokeback Mountain. But it wasn't a total shutout for the cowboy romance. Brokeback Mountain's Ang Lee used the film's signature line when accepting the award for Best Director.
I wish I knew how to quit you.
The Daily Show's Jon Stewart hosted the evening with a mix of his classic political humor.
Bjork couldn't be here tonight. She was trying on her Oscar dress and Dick Cheney shot her.
And a few jokes at the expense of Hollywood.
Good night and good luck, which is not just Edward R. Murrow's sign-off. It's also how Mr. Clooney ends all his dates. Now,
George Clooney, nominated for 3 Academy Awards for 2 different films, took home the first Oscar of the night for Best Supporting Actor in Syriana. Clooney praised Oscar voters for their willingness to reward out-of-the-mainstream films.
I'm proud to be a part of this Academy. Proud to be part of the community. I'm proud to be out of touch.
The Constant Gardener's Rachel Weisz won the Oscar for Best Supporting Actress. The Best Actor Award, as most industry experts predicted, went to Capote's Philip Seymour Hoffman. And the man of the evening thanked his mom.
Be proud, Mom, because I'm proud of you, and we're here tonight, and it's so good.
Reese Witherspoon won the Best Actress Oscar for her portrayal of June Carter Cash in Walk the Line. She thanked her grandmother.
My grandmother was one of the biggest inspirations in my life. She taught me how to be a real woman.
And also honored the woman she played.
And people used to ask June how she was doing, and she used to say, I'm just trying to matter. And I know what she means, you know. I'm just trying to matter and live a good life and make work that means something.
A significant night for all the Oscar winners. Sibylla Vargas, CNN, Hollywood.
Well, if you're like me, you wait until after the Oscars and then you start renting the movies because you don't know which ones are really that decent. I watched Crash and, look, I thought it was going to be an Oscar winner and then was surprised that it didn't have a lot of nominations. And Brokeback Mountain, of course, had all those nominations, didn't get much. What did you think of the Oscars if you watched them last night? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. What was the best movie that you watched either on the big screen or rented this last year? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Best callers will get Brian Godawa's book called Hollywood Worldviews, Watching Film with Wisdom and Discernment. Let's start with Terry calling from her car. Terry, thanks for waiting. Welcome to Issues Etc.
Hi.
Hi, Terry.
I really liked Glory Road a lot.
What was this one about?
It's about the basketball team, West Texas, that was the first African-American basketball team to win the NCAA.
What did you like about it, Terry?
I'm not even that overly fond of basketball, but I could hardly wait to see them win.
Really?
And it was all about team. It was about family. It was about heart. There was not a Christian message to it, but there was sure a family message.
Terry, thank you very much. I would say Terry's is Glory Road, this film about an all-black basketball team. You know, if they say, well, this is just me. When it comes to sports and film, I think sports, I'm not that interested in sports, even when it's not in a story. But it does make good movies. Some of the very best movies have been about teams or athletes or the competition. So she says Glory Road. What about the rest of you? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Were you surprised that Brokeback Mountain, which walked away with so many nominations, didn't actually win Best Picture? It's Open Lines, Issues, Etc. We're coming to you live this Monday, the 6th of March. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Up next, Chuck from St. Louis. Hi, Chuck.
Hey, Todd.
Hey.
I think the best movie that I rented this year and watched with my wife was a movie called Mad Hot Ballroom Dancing.
You're kidding me.
No. Fabulous movie.
Was it a documentary?
Yes, it was. It was about the program in the New York City schools for sixth graders to teach them ballroom dancing as part of their gym class. And what was accomplished was not just that a bunch of kids learned how to move across the dance floor. What was accomplished was a several things on lots of layers. First of all, a way that you act in respect to other people, particularly your partner, with whom you get partnered because of their ability, not because you like them necessarily. And you act in a certain way towards all the dancers. You bow, you address, you know, you comport yourself in such a fashion as to bring a sense of dignity to the action of the dance. And then you watch the kids learn to dance, and you know, some of it's funny as they make mistakes. But at the end, you find yourself cheering for the kids who end up winning.
Wow. Do you ballroom dance, Chuck?
No.
Chuck, thank you very much for the call. Okay, so for Chuck, it was Mad Hot Ballroom Dancing. Okay, don't think Girls Gone Wild. Think kids learning how to ballroom dance. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. I didn't even know it existed. But there are more movies out there than are dreamt of in my philosophy, that's for sure. It's Open Lines, Issues, Etc., 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Did you see the film that ended up getting Best Picture, Crash? I rented it, having heard just people say Crash, Crash, and I thought, okay, I'm going to rent it. And I'd heard someone say it was one of these films that is so popular nowadays where you've got this huge ensemble cast that all have different stories, and the stories all kind of interweave into one big story with a general theme. And I love those kind of films, so I rented it, watched it. I was completely blown away by it. I thought it was great. And then when it didn't get all the nominations come Oscar nomination time, I was a little disappointed. I thought Brokeback Mountain's going to carry it away, but it didn't. Did you watch the Oscars last night? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. What was your favorite film of 2005? Open Lines, Issues, Etc. We'll get an update on that Da Vinci Code courtroom case after this, as well as your phone calls. Stay tuned.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues Etc., please visit the audio archive section at KFUO.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM850 KFUO. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.